The Serbs' systematic raping of Bosnian women returns us to the issue of whether certain kinds of excess cruelty, particularly Machiavellian, in themselves constitute an eliminationist means, beyond the international criminal courts codifying it as a crime against humanity. Even more than general politically inspired cruelty, intended to weaken or subjugate victim peoples, the Serbs raped Bosnian women as an explicit strategy, eliminationism by preventing a people's reproduction. They sought, effectively, to create a form of social sterilization that was cheaper, easier, and far more emotionally and psychically gratifying to administer than surgical sterilization. Thus, the Serbs' eliminationist means, used as interchangeable or complementary instruments against Bosniaks, included killing, expulsion, and rape to prevent reproduction and terrorize the Bosniaks into fleeing forever. The Serbs repeated this political sexual cruelty strategy, this sexual eliminationist strategy, in Kosovo. It utterly terrorized the Kosovars, who already knew of the Serbs' raping in Bosnia. One woman conveyed the terror's magnitude in unmistakable comparative terms. "I wasn't afraid of the killing. I was afraid of the raping." According to a Kosovar doctor in Pristina, "Rape was our greatest fear. Our main goal was to get our daughters, aged 25, 21, 14, and 10, out of the country." Even before raping as a constitutive feature of some eliminationist assaults became broadly known to the world, Pakistanis employed the same strategy in their mass murderous and eliminationist attacks in 1971 against Bangladesh, raping perhaps 200,000 Bangladeshi women. Pakistanis regularly raped them in front of family members and established rape camps for their soldiers. One Indian liberator testified to two such places in Vurungamari. "After breaking down the door of the room of the circle officer's office where the women were kept, we were dumbfounded. We found four naked young women who had been physically tortured, raped, and battered by the Pakistani soldiers. We tried to talk to them, but all of them were still in shock. One of them was 6 to 7 months pregnant. One was a college student from Meeman Singh. We found 16 other women locked up in a room at Vurungamari High School. These women were brought in for the Pakistani soldiers from nearby villages. We found evidence in the rooms of the circle officer's office which showed that these women were tied to the window bars and were repeatedly raped by the Pakistani soldiers. The whole floor was covered with blood, torn pieces of clothing, and strands of long hair." The vast scale and systematic character of the Pakistanis' raping led Mulk Raj Anand, an Indian novelist, to conclude it must have been a policy planned by the West Pakistanis in a deliberate effort to create a new race, or at least an enormous number of outcasts, to weaken Bangladeshi society. The Pakistanis understood well their sexual violence's political efficacy. A month after Pakistanis had gang-raped one young woman, then a bride, she was in a shelter for rape victims in Dhaka. Her husband had cast her out, her father was ashamed, and the people of her village did not want me. Throughout history, raping the enemy has often been seen as a war spoil. No doubt the intersection of war's violence and licentiousness and young men's sexual urges, together with hatred of the enemy, has formed a combustible context for Conradian sexual cruelty and vengeful sexual cruelty. Such cruelty's emblem is perhaps the Japanese assault on Nanjing in 1937. In the first month, the Japanese raped and murdered perhaps 20,000 Chinese women so openly and blatantly that the entire mass murder and eliminationist subjugation became known as the Rape of Nanking, Nanjing. Not just eliminationist assaults, but, barring extremely tight monitoring and severe sanctions, large-scale military conflicts usually include considerable sexual cruelty. Soldiers often feel rage toward the people of the country or the group they fight for, having endangered their lives, having plunged them into war's barbarous and discomforting conditions, having injured, killed, or otherwise harmed their comrades, loved ones, and people. They can and often do take out this rage in retributive sprees upon the easy and fulfilling targets of conquered women. Victorious Soviet soldiers, whose country suffered immensely at the hands of the German army and occupiers, were repeatedly urged to wreak vengeance on the Germans. They did so on a vast scale against German women. Most eliminationist assaults, as we know, are nothing like war, as the perpetrators themselves do not face armies. They are politically inspired and politically understood programs designed to achieve transformative goals. In Bosnia and then Kosovo and earlier in Bangladesh, the perpetrators institutionalized sexual cruelty as a critical eliminationist political strategy. As with eliminationist assault in general, the perpetrators' conception of their victims prepared them to use sexual cruelty instrumentally. Members of strongly patriarchal cultures often depict rival, hated, or enemy groups' women in a symbolically potent manner, wresting all virtue from them, including by contrasting them unfavorably to their own culture's women, deemed, at least comparatively, wholesome. They also see the demeaned women, standing in for the whole group, as a source of disorder and others' corruption. Long before the Serbs' eliminationist assault began in full force against the Kosovars, the Serbs had degraded Kosovar women so viciously as to border on dehumanization. Serbian society's discourse, including crucially on state-run media, presented Kosovar women as baby factories and their many children as biological bombs that obviously had to be defused. According to one Kosovar woman, "During the late 1980s, there was tremendous propaganda against Kosovar Albanian women. We were portrayed as open-legged, stupid, uneducated women ready to have sex." When the eliminationist assault began, the Serbs, reviving their Bosnian strategy, carried out their ideologically driven mission of sexual cruelty, raping the women they construed as asking for it. In Darfur, the political Islamic regime's perpetrators, many of whom are part of the government-sponsored and aided Janjaweed militia, have also been using rape as a political weapon to terrorize the Darfurians, get them to flee, and undermine their collective strength. The extensive testimonies Amnesty International collected point to rape and other forms of sexual violence being used as a weapon of war in Darfur in order to humiliate, punish, control, inflict fear, and displace women and their communities. Rape and other forms of sexual violence in Darfur are not just a consequence of the conflict or of the result of the conduct of undisciplined troops. The voluminous reports of the perpetrators' raping have understated its actual incidence because, as always, many women shy away from reporting rape, and additionally, as one victim explains, "In our culture, it is a shame, and women will hide this in their hearts so that the men do not hear about it." If the men do, the consequences in this patriarchal and puritanical society are often terrible. One 16-year-old explained in 2005 what happened when, after being gang-raped the year before, she told her family. "They threw me out of the home and I had to build my own hut away from them. I was engaged to a man and I was so much looking forward to getting married. After I got raped, he did not want to marry me and broke off the engagement because he said that I was now disgraced and spoiled. It is the worst thing for me." When she was 8 months pregnant, the police arrested her at gunpoint. "I told them that I had been raped. They told me that as I was not married, I will deliver this baby illegally. They beat me with a whip on the chest and back and put me in jail, where, housed in deplorable conditions with other similarly situated women, she stayed for 10 days. The perpetrators know well how the women they rape will be treated in their communities and the long-term harm they do the women as well as their families and society. The political Islamists laying waste to Darfur have integrated rape into their eliminationist repertoire of descending on villages, burning homes, killing many people, expelling many more, and raping as they please. Like the Serbs in Bosnia, they have set up rape camps where they enslave Darfurian women. One victim, Asha, describes the rape camp of her imprisonment as systematically run. "There were 35 women taken, and they split us up, one for each group of Janjaweed. This is common procedure. If women are few, they divide us 5 or 6 Janjaweed per woman. If there are enough women after their daily collections, then it's 1 to 1. This points to another of the Holocaust's unusual features. Germans rarely raped Jewish women. Why, given the Germans' total demonization and dehumanization of Jews, their unsurpassable thirst for vengeance, their ready and steady infliction of virtually every kind of horror upon them, did they desist in this one cruel practice that is eliminationist assault's virtual hallmark, which perpetrators appear to need little more than Conradian opportunity to widely practice? The Germans' sexual restraint vis-à-vis Jews is still more noteworthy, as it differed from their ready sexual use and abuse of non-Jewish victims, including the dehumanized but not demonized Russians and others. The Germans did not rape Jewish women for powerful and mutually reinforcing reasons. The German regime outlawed sexual relations with Jews, severely punishing offenders, sometimes by death. While this may seem to demonstrate regime's power to prevent excess cruelty, in many, perhaps most settings, individual or small groups of Germans could do whatever they wanted with Jewish women with de facto impunity, as the German authorities deemed a Jew's testimony, as a matter of definition, mendacious and without value, especially against a German's word. And according to the German Security Service's own report in 1942, similar German army attempts to ban any kind of sexual intercourse with Russian women and girls have up to now been without any noteworthy effect. This included widespread rape. So probably a second reason far more powerful inhibited Germans from raping Jewish women. Germans genuinely feared that these enemies, deemed biologically potent and demonic, would pollute them. They wanted to expose themselves to this danger no more than to intimate contact with a leper, or, more precisely, a demonic leper. The Germans genuinely held that sexual relations with Jewish women would racially, that is, biologically, endanger the German man. The act evoked such horror it had a now-discarded German name, Rassenschande, meaning race defilement, which was also the punishable legal offense's name. The Germans' reserve toward Jewish women aside, exterminationist and eliminationist perpetrators, as with excess cruelty's other major forms, frequently practiced rape. The Guatemalan Commission for Historical Clarification's investigation has demonstrated that the rape of women during torture or before being murdered was a common practice aimed at destroying one of the most intimate and vulnerable aspects of the individual's dignity. The majority of rape victims were Mayan women. Those who survived the crime still suffer profound trauma as a result of this aggression, and the communities themselves were deeply offended by this practice. The presence of sexual violence in the social memory of the communities has become a source of collective shame. Yet raping varies from one eliminationist onslaught to the next, depending on a host of familiar factors, including perpetrators' conception of the victims, commanders' restraints, if any, on their men, each eliminationist onslaught's character, creating differing settings and opportunities, and the perpetrator's political understanding of chastity, defilement, even ethnically mixed progeny, and the aims to which they may be put. For the British in Kenya, raping the putatively subhuman Kikuyu women seems hardly to have been a socially significant act. Milka Muriuki explains, "The white officers had no shame. They would rape women in full view of everyone. They would take whomever they wanted at one corner and just do it right there." The British, seeing the Kikuyu women as utilitarian playthings, raped them regularly. While respecting the colonialist pecking order, either themselves raping their victims first and then letting the British Home Guards, their Kikuyu loyalists, take their turns, or dividing them up with the British taking the choicest victims, usually adolescents whom they called unplucked chickens, for themselves. The scene described earlier of Major Wawanjiru and his men torturing Kikuyu men and women, culminating with them carting the men away and killing them, continued in a different manner of cruelty for the women. Esther Muchiri explains, "That night all of the women, including myself, were divided amongst the home guards and raped. Even this lady who was 8 months pregnant was not spared. We were raped throughout the night." Whatever a given eliminationist assault's baseline sexual cruelty, it varies, as with other forms of excess cruelty, in its implementation according to individual perpetrators' personalities and pathologies. Rape is a familiar but little focused upon and theorized aspect of mass murders, expulsions, and eliminationist politics. Eliminationist rape has produced an institution that, until the Serbs' assault on Bosnians, was not known or recognized for what it is, a new kind of camp in the universe of camps, the rape camp. This failure occurred even though one formal rape camp system, though not conceptualized as such and not leading to further study and theorizing, has been well known. The Japanese's so-called comfort stations, populating their vast domination, elimination, and exploitation empire. In them, they imprisoned perhaps 200,000 sex slaves, euphemistically called comfort women. Yasuji Kaneko, a Japanese soldier, raped countless women in such camps and also in villages in China with, whatever other emotions, a blunt callousness. "They cried out, but it didn't matter to us whether the women lived or died." The Japanese master race, especially its warriors, conceived of these women as subhumans to be used, like all Chinese, Koreans, and others, in a utilitarian manner, as objects to be exploited and discarded. "We were the emperor's soldiers. Whether in military brothels or in the villages, we raped without reluctance." Eliminationist rape remains out of focus and untheorized as a political and eliminationist act and strategy, even though it appears to be as widespread as such assaults' other aspects. Johannes Kruger, a prominent bastard serving with the Germans through their annihilationist campaign against the Herero, conveys the slaughter's extended butchery, and that for Germans, raping and killing, usually with bayonets, went hand in hand. Kruger says he and the other Africans refused to kill Herero women and children, but the Germans spared none. They killed thousands and thousands. "I saw this bloody work for days and days and every day. Often, and especially at Waterberg, the young Herero women and girls were violated by the German soldiers before being killed. Two of my Hottentots were invited by the German soldiers to join them in violating Herero girls. The two Hottentots refused to do so." Many Armenian survivors testify to their own and others' rapes. One woman relates that on her death march, all the old women and the weak who were unable to walk were killed. "There were about 100 Kurdish guards over us, and our lives depended on their pleasure. It was a very common thing for them to rape our girls in our presence. Very often they violated 8- or 10-year-old girls, and as a consequence many would be unable to walk and were shot. When their forlorn, bedraggled column passed a village and a Kurd fancied a girl, nothing would prevent him from taking her." Reciting this practice's sickening horrors alone could fill an entire book. In scenes perpetrators acted out seemingly endlessly in Bosnia and other eliminationist onslaughts, two Bosnian women in Foča recount Serbs bringing them and two other women to an apartment and repeatedly raping them while their children watched. Their sexual torturers continually conveyed to them their motivation's eliminationist dimension. One woman explains, "The four of them raped me one after the other. They told us we were going to give birth to Serbian children, and they would do everything they could so we wouldn't even dare think of coming back again. The second woman recalls the rapists becoming enraged when she stood up without permission, even though they had ordered her to do the dishes. "Fuck your Turkish mother," and "Death to all Turkish sperm." These women's and much other testimony demonstrates that the perpetrators conceive of politically inspired and organized rape as constituting a particular form of eliminationist violence. As one Serb explained to his victim, the Serbs wanted to plant the seeds of Serbs in Bosnia. And as another Bosnian rape victim recounts, her tormentors said they wanted to drive us out, that there shouldn't be any more Muslims in Europe. The political Islamic Janjaweed perpetrators in Darfur are just as explicit. Many rape victims and witnesses report that the Janjaweed, or the women accompanying them, have sought to humiliate them with abusive language and songs. One victim relates, "When we tried to escape, they shot more children. They raped women. I saw many cases of Janjaweed raping women and girls. They are happy when they rape. They sing when they rape, and they tell that we are just slaves and that they can do with us how they wish." Another woman testifies that, "I was sleeping when the attack on Disa started. I was taken away by the attackers. They were all in uniforms. They took dozens of other girls and made us walk for 3 hours. During the day we were beaten, and they were telling us, 'You, the black women, we will exterminate you. You have no God.' At night, we were raped several times." Eliminationist rape and other sexual violence constitute excess cruelty directed at women. They differ from eliminationist politics, violence, and cruelty's other forms, which perpetrators, in principle and usually in practice, inflict against all the victim group's available members, men or women, young or old. The perpetrator's particular and politically purposeful victimization of women in this singular way, especially when sanctioned, creates a daily impetus, indeed libidinal drive, to make the victim suffer, producing excess violence and suffering that are more frequent, systematic, and widespread than the perpetrator's other cruelties. Lest anyone think the raping, especially when organized and institutionalized, is just boys being boys, or something other than intricately interwoven into eliminationist or exterminationist assault's other purposely cruel aspects, everyone should ponder certain indicative rapes from Rwanda. Discussing the Hutus' massive, indiscriminate raping of women, old, young, children, Rwandan Minister of Justice Tarcisse Karuga Rama, in one brilliant answer to the question, "What motivated the perpetrators to rape?" lays out eliminationist rape's critical elements. First, he explains rape's purpose. Rape was used as an instrument of genocide, to humiliate the people, to humiliate the victims. Then he explains its particular source grounded in the perpetrator's conception of the victims, which produced in the Hutu the desire for vengeance. Because there was this feeling that, particularly among certain people, that these guys, the Tutsi, despise you. Their women think you are not worth their sex, so violate them. Then Karuga Rama adduces what can be seen as eliminationist rape's emblematic and most analytically significant instance. "We have a woman in Arusha who was standing, encouraging her sons to rape as a sign of victory, as a sign of self-important and self-aggrandizement, as a sign of being raised to another level, of having raped a Tutsi woman." He continues, "We have instances where women encouraged their husbands to rape as a sign that these women have now conquered the Tutsi woman. They are now more superior because the Tutsi woman is down and beaten." This is not boys being boys. It is mothers and wives being boys. Yet mothers and wives were driving their sons and husbands to rape for reasons that had nothing to do with sexual pleasure, but for eliminationist ends, for some combination of cruelty's multiple purposes and satisfactions. Karuga Rama concludes his analysis, So you can imagine, under normal circumstances, their wife would never encourage their husband to do rape. Exactly. Eliminationist circumstances, cruelty's vengeance and satisfactions, here gave women the spur to become rapists and to reveal the raping's real nature. In another way, Constance's and Denise's stories do as well. Constance, along with other Tutsi women, was a rape camp prisoner. Over time, all the women became weaker and weaker because we had not been given any food. The Interahamwe told us that they would kill us before we died of hunger, but that they wanted to make us suffer more. The repeated and institutionalized raping was an integral part of the Hutu's larger eliminationist agenda. The perpetrators starved the women, told them they would kill them, and let them know they intended to keep them alive as long as possible while starving them so the women would suffer maximally. This rape camp interlude of this cruelty and torture's multiple and intertwined forms came immediately after these same perpetrators had slaughtered the women's husbands and children, and immediately before they fulfilled their promise to kill all the women, whom they eventually marched away and macheted to the last one. Constance, too. I was cut on the head with a machete and left because they thought I was dead. I was put into a mass grave that night, and when I regained consciousness, I got out of the grave and ran in the bushes, only, before eventually fleeing to safety, to be raped again by 4 young Hutu, one as young as 12, at a roadblock where older Hutu watched and encouraged them. When the Hutu attacked Denise's community, her husband jumped out of their house's window and fled. Some neighbors were among the 6 or so Hutu barging into her house with machetes and torches. When Denise refused to reveal her husband's whereabouts, they began to beat me on the legs with sticks. Then one of them raped me. He said, "You are lucky. Your God is still with you because we don't want to kill you. Now the Hutu have won. You Tutsi, we are going to exterminate you. You won't own anything." Then, after lording it over her that the Hutu were vanquishing and exterminating all the Tutsi except her, he demonstrated his sickening sarcasm in saying that she, unlike all other Tutsi slated for death, was lucky in being spared. When he finished, he took me inside and put me on a bed. He held one leg of mine open, and another one held the other leg. He called everyone who was outside and said, "You come and see how Tutsikazi are on the inside." Then he said, "You Tutsikazi, you think you are the only beautiful women in the world." Then he cut out the inside of my vagina. He took the flesh outside, took a small stick and put what he had cut on the top. He stuck the stick in the ground outside the door and was shouting, "Everyone who comes past her will see how Tutsikazi look." Then he came back inside and beat me again. Here, and often across Rwanda, the perpetrator's raping was accompanied by gruesome genital mutilation and torture. The Hutu were exacting sexual revenge against Tutsi women, whom, they said, mantra-like, thought themselves better and more beautiful than Hutu. Additionally, perpetrators often performed this sexual revenge for demonstration purposes, and, in this instance, to create a singularly grotesque display they fully expected onlooking Hutu to enjoy. The shamelessness, indeed the moral order's inversion, public demonstration of cruelty and otherwise unimaginable suffering as righting the world, is eliminationist assault's common feature. The gruesome cruelty, so revolting yet so common and so eagerly inflicted, and then publicly consumed and appreciated among Rwanda's Hutu and by other eliminationist assaults perpetrators and supporting community members, is enormously lurid and disturbing merely as print on the page. I considered not including here even the words of Denise, this last victim, which, as mere words, do not and cannot convey 1/1,000th of her pain and suffering's horror. I nevertheless decided to present her testimony, because we must behold, as best we can, the perpetrator's actual, not sanitized, deeds if we want to understand why they do what they do, which is not to robotically and clinically and dispassionately execute their victims and do nothing else to them, but, among the many other non-robotic, non-clinical, no-foot-dragging, non-reluctant, non-coerced, and horrifying acts the perpetrators regularly perpetrate, to do that. A Human Rights Watch study of Hutus raping during the annihilationist onslaught, based on extensive interviews with victims, concludes, often the rape of women was accompanied or followed by mutilation of the sexual organs or of features held to be characteristic of the Tutsi ethnic group. Sexual mutilations included the pouring of boiling water into the vagina, the opening of the womb to cut out an unborn child before killing the mother, cutting off breasts, slashing the pelvis area, and the mutilation of vaginas. Assailants mutilated features considered Tutsi, including thin noses and long fingers. Conchessa Kairaba, part of a community of rape victims victimized by the Hutu of their own village, including their own neighbors, explains, they used their sex as a killing weapon. After that, they would insert objects in the vagina like sticks and add in chili pepper. So I think their plan was to kill. They were evil. Ingarambi, speaking for the perpetrators, who he says boasted about raping Tutsi women, confirms the Hutu rapists' eliminationist motivation. There was nothing else they wanted the Tutsi they raped for except to humiliate them, to throw away their humanness, and to make them lose their Rwandan image they had before. The annals of eliminationist rape, in Rwanda, in Bosnia, and elsewhere, and now, especially with Rwandan exile Hutu militias in the Democratic Republic of Congo and political Islamists in Darfur, contain legions of such sexual mutilations, which, together with the perpetrators' boastful statements, show that the perpetrators' pleasure in raping is principally the pleasure of making the hated victims suffer, of displaying the perpetrators' utter domination, of appropriating its women, of, in the perpetrators' minds, multiple layers of irony, mocking, and cruelty, enjoyment physically and symbolically turning the tables on, and permanently marking the victims, done all in the name of what the perpetrators believe the victims deserve. Alisa Muratkaus, in addition to being president of the Association of Concentration Camp Torture Survivors in Sarajevo, to which 1,000 women belong, many of whom were raped and held in rape camps, was herself a rape victim and rape camp survivor. She could not be clearer that for the perpetrators, rape was a politically motivated eliminationist weapon, emanating from hatred, hatred born of their conception of Muslims as pernicious alien invaders who had to be eradicated. She knows it because the Serbs repeatedly told it to her sister, and the other victims, including 5,000 men, for whom she speaks, as she in so many ways conveyed to me during a long interview in Sarajevo. A lot of women, especially Bosniak women and Catholic Croatian women, we are brutally raped and suffered the grossest kind of physical and psychological torture at the hands of the enemies. Rape was systematically used as a weapon of biological genocide to separate women from their communities, to separate women from families, to criminally humiliate the family of raped women. Women of different ages were raped. Some were only 11 or 12 years old, and some of these young children often died because of the extreme assault. Some soldiers raped my sister. Told her, "You will have a baby. You will bring new life. It will be Serbian. Serbian. Just Serbian people. We will destroy you, all of you. We will destroy, definitely. Bosnia is, and Herzegovina is, a Serbian land, and there will be no Croatian people. Bosnian people. Just Serbian people." The Serbs explained to her and others the source of their hatred. They told us, "You are Turkish. You are Balija," a derogatory term. "We will kill you." We will rape you, kill you, hard. Asked whether the Serbs explained why they wanted to kill her, she chuckled as if the question were naive and absurd, the answer being so obvious. Yes, they just needed to know that we are Bosniak. It's enough for them. Okay, we will kill you. We will expel you. This is Serbian land, and just Serbian people will live here, not you. The Serbs raped the Bosnian women in anything but a matter-of-fact way of having a job to do. The rapists lorded their eliminationist deeds over them, cutting them with their knives, carving into their breasts an Orthodox cross. Why? They hated us a lot. This is really a special hate. The Serbs boasted to their victims. They were yelling at us, ha ha ha, you will have Serbian babies, Serbian children, and mockingly offered to bring their victims an Orthodox priest, if you want, to hasten their Serbification. Asked whether the Serbs ever showed sympathy toward the victims, Murat Kaos was emphatic. No. Actually, sexually, they enjoyed it to make you suffer, to torture you. They enjoyed to torture you, to show they are very brave, that they are very strong. Murat Kaos told me that the raping was unequivocally political. Definitely it was, yes. Not sexual expression, just the expression of the... Actually, they hated us. Just to cause fear in us, to expel us, to speed up ethnic cleansing. Definitely. Women's particular vulnerability to this particular cruelty and torture, and the predictable and special fear it engenders when perpetrators practice it widely, render women's plight under eliminationist politics threat, or as its intended victims in this significant aspect and probably overall, qualitatively different from and often worse than men's. While analysis of and policy response to eliminationist politics must focus on its core, this sui generis feature requires special attention. This ought to include the fundamental recognition that rape, as excess cruelty and preventive reproduction, is in many eliminationist assaults a principal eliminationist means, complementing and functionally equivalent to mass murder and expulsion. A Masalit woman from West Darfur, raped by 10 soldiers in the presence of her baby and daughter and left bleeding and unable to walk, explains that the perpetrators themselves, who burnt down her undefended and rebel-free village, portray rape, just as the Serbs in Bosnia did, in this way. They were saying the government from Khartoum sent them and we were to be killed and raped and cleaned from the land. Just as eliminationist perpetrators target women in particular ways, they do children as well. Obviously, children are innocent of committing any transgression. Yet race, kinship, group membership, or some other perpetrator principle leads most eliminationist perpetrators to think children ought to roughly share their parents' and people's fate. The perpetrators' conception of their victims as existential enemies, heretics, subhumans, or demons usually, though far from invariably, encompasses the victim's children as well, and, powerfully informing emotions, manages to efface the tenderness and protectiveness many feel, seemingly naturally, for children. Even worse, the brutality eliminationist politics perpetrators inflict upon children is often ferocious. As with excess cruelty, we need to account for the perpetrator's violence against children, even small children, and then its variations. That perpetrators willfully, even eagerly, slaughter or expel children, and furthermore often subject them to excess cruelty, is comprehensible once it is understood that perpetrators willingly target groups and peoples for elimination because they believe them to be, frequently dehumanized or demonized beings, substantially endangering themselves, their families, or their transformative vision. In short, according to perpetrators' conception of the victim group, the children, if not already noxious, will grow into the putatively hateful and dangerous beings their parents are. They pose an inherent potential future threat, which perpetrators expect will further intensify, as will the children's desire to revenge themselves on the people behind their parents' suffering and elimination. So the children, like their parents, must, in one way or another, go. While this line of reasoning's particulars vary depending on perpetrators' conception of victims as existential enemies, heretics, subhumans, or demons, its essential easy-to-follow thread helps explain why the perpetrators and their supporters, often parents themselves, shut down the solicitude ordinarily reserved for children, feeling little or no compunction in eliminating them. Once children are caught in eliminationist violence's maelstrom that, in any case, tends to become indiscriminate at the point of attack, the perpetrators treat them horribly. Because children, especially infants and small children, are especially vulnerable, they suffer and die disproportionately more just by receiving equal treatment. Nevertheless, children's fates vary widely during eliminationist onslaughts. When eliminationist assaults are wholly or primarily mass murderous, the perpetrator's treatment of children takes three basic forms, each deriving mainly from the perpetrator's conception of the victims and their threat.